Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY Allentown, listener-supported community public radio, NPR, in the Lehigh Valley. I'm John Pierce, host of Lehigh Valley Discourse, and this evening we have a guest host, Peggy Campbell. Peggy, what is our topic for this evening?
Oh, thank you very much, John. It's a pleasure to be here. Our topic this evening is writing, especially writing for the young adult audience. And the other subject that we're going to be looking at is the Moravian College Writers Conference that's coming up in June. It's a pleasure to have Joyce Hinnefeld, Paul Akampura, and Jordan Sonnenblick with us this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Joyce Hinnefeld holds the Cohen Chair in English and Literature at Moravian College. She is a writer and a teacher of writing who hails from southern Indiana with an MA in English from Northwestern University and a PhD in English from State University of New York in Albany. Joyce, your work has appeared in literary, scholarly, and online publications, and you have a short story collection that I bought back in 1998, Tell Me Everything. I'm happy to say that that's been a pleasure for me to read. Your first novel, In Hovering Flight, was published in 2008, and your most recent novel, Stranger Here Below, in 2010. So you've been busy. But the reason we're coming together tonight is to discuss what you've been most busy about most recently, and that is preparing for the Moravian Writers Conference in June. So welcome to the show, Joyce.
Thank you, Peggy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Jordan Sonnenblick is the author of 6 award-winning and very successful novels for young adult readers. His most recent novel, Are You Experienced?, was published by Macmillan in 2013 and was a fall 2013 Junior Literary Guild selection. Jordan Sonnenblick is a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, a former Teach for America member, and a public high school teacher for 14 years. He was also a student of the legendary Frank McCourt, something we'll hear more about later in the show. Jordan lives in Bethlehem and is one of the featured authors of young adult literature at the Moravian Writers Conference. So welcome to the show, Jordan.
Thank you very much.
Paul Akampura is also the successful author of numerous books for young adults and teens, including his soon-to-be-released novel, I Kill the Mockingbird, which I'm really eager to hear about because it plays on the title of one of my favorite books, To Kill a Mockingbird. Publishers Weekly called his first novel, Defining Dulcie, a carefully crafted, impressive debut, and Voya magazine declared it a perfect 10. And I'm happy to say Paul Akampura has not disappointed anyone with his recent novels and short stories. Paul is a former grade school teacher as well who lives in Allentown and is now an administrator at Northampton Community College. He writes for elementary school, middle school, and teen readers. Paul is also a featured author at the Moravian Writers Conference. So welcome to the show, Paul.
Thanks, Peggy.
Well, there's so much to talk about, but I'd like to get started first with the conference, Joyce. Can you tell us where the idea came for this Moravian College Writers Conference?
Sure. I've been thinking about something like this for, longer than I probably want to admit. Since I moved to the Lehigh Valley, since I started teaching at Moravian, and fairly quickly got acquainted with a lot of writers in the area, including Paul. We've known each other for a long time, and Paul is the great connector who has connected me with Jordan and lots of other folks. And so at some point I just thought, we really need to do something together, all of us. I mean, it was really sort of that pie in the sky. But it took me a long time to envision what that would be, and it's a product of having gone to writers' conferences on some occasions, thinking through what kind of model would work well here in this community, what we could do that isn't quite being done already, because there are valuable writers' conferences in the area already, but ours will be a bit different. So over time, that got clearer for me, and I also just got very excited about the idea of hosting the conference on Moravian College's South Campus, the Heard Campus, in the historic center of Bethlehem, because I'm really in love with those historic buildings and the grounds behind them. And I just think it's going to be a beautiful place to be in June, to be together with other writers and talking about writing. So
how would you say that this conference is different from all those other writers' conferences out there? And I've been to many writers' conferences myself, so I...
Right. Well, I think it will have things in common with other conferences in that there will be workshops, and many of them do provide workshops and craft talks, the sorts of things that we're offering. But we're really delving into the craft of writing and the building of a community of writers. I think that's such a, that's been so important to me. I've been in a writers group with Paul for a long time now. Before that, I was in a writers group in New York for a very long time in my earlier life. And that sense of having other members of the tribe to talk to has been really important to me. So I've tried to make that a focus of what we're doing. It will keep it relatively small. There will be all kinds of occasions to talk to the writers who are faculty members and to the keynote speakers who are two very well-known writers who will be with us through the weekend. And while we will do some discussion of the business of writing, the publishing side, we have a couple literary agents who will be with us. That isn't going to be our primary focus. Our primary focus is really going to be making the work and making the work better.
And just as we sort of get this information straight at the beginning, when is the registration deadline for this conference?
We have listed May 16th as our registration deadline on the conference website. And that is all you need to do is Google Moravian Writers Conference, and it should take you there pretty easily. It's moravian.edu/writers-conference. And everything's there, and I think it's pretty easy to navigate. But we are setting May 16th as our deadline. We'd like to try to get everybody signed up by then so that we can get the wheels in motion to have the weekend everything prepared for everyone so things run smoothly.
Now, will there be some events that people can attend who aren't attending the whole conference?
There will be a reading on Saturday, June 7th in Foy Hall on the Heard campus by the two keynote writers, Ursula Hagee, who many people know as the author of Stones from the River. That was sort of her breakthrough book, and she's written other books in that series, the Bergdorf Cycle books, since then. And Laurie Hulse Anderson, who we like to call a rock star. She's much, much loved as a young adult writer, and she writes for children. She has many, many books. Probably the best known is her novel Speak, which was published 15 years ago. There's been a lot of press about the 15th anniversary of the publication of that book because of the ways in which it's educated people about sexual assault and the issue of consent among teenagers. It's a really, it was quite a, maybe I won't say scandalous, but a shocking book, I think, for a lot of people when it was published. And it's just had a life that's gone on and on and on. So we're excited about both of those people being in Bethlehem, and they will give a reading and speak in Foy Hall at 8 o'clock on Saturday, June 7th. Tickets are free, but you do need a ticket. And so they'll be available at the Moravian Bookshop and also by calling a number that's listed on the website.
Now, I know you have a terrific lineup for this, including Lee Upton, the poet from Lafayette College.
Right.
But who do you see coming to the conference? Because you do have, it seems like you have a young adult theme.
Well, yeah, we have a number of young adult writers, but, you know, we also have, you could say we have a memoir theme. We have a couple of people who are doing really interesting work with memoir. Lee is actually doing a workshop on humor writing. You know, besides her poetry, she's a fantastic essayist and short story writer, and she's very funny, if you know Lee. We have a poet coming to do a workshop, B.J. Ward, from New Jersey, who's really having a very successful career as a poet. So we have all genres represented. So really, anyone working in any genre. And we're saying at any level. You know, you can be getting ready to start that memoir that you've wanted to write forever, and now you're retired and ready to start it. That's perfect. You're welcome. You can be just coming. We'll have some high school students there, actually, some accomplished writers who've been recommended by their teachers. So a wide range.
And then when the workshops that Jordan and Paul, you'll be conducting workshop as well. So how do you picture what you'll be doing?
I'm going to work really hard to pretend I know what I'm doing. I think that's really important, to act informed and informative. No.
I'll be copying Jordan.
Yeah, Paul and I will be giving each other significant, intelligent-looking glances. No, I mean, we've done this before, but what I will honestly be doing is, I've written 9 books, actually, the 6 young adult novels and 3 novels for younger kids. And I was also a middle school and elementary school teacher for 14 years. And if you've taught writing for a gajillion years and you've written 9 books, you see some connections. And you read as a teacher and you read as a writer and you see certain things that you can do to lead people through their process, whether they're, you know, fifth graders or 80-year-olds, there are still common things that people have to do to get through a piece of text and weave it together as a successful narrative. And so I've kind of broken it down and I'm running workshops, which I'm sure is what we all kind of do. You see what the sticky points are and what exercises you can do to jog people through them. And that's all we're trying to do. We're saying, I'm someone who does these certain things at a professional level. Here's what I've learned and here's how I can give it back. And for me, I think that's almost a sacred responsibility because we'll talk about this later. But I lucked out. My high school creative writing teacher was Frank McCourt. I feel a tremendous karmic debt to try to teach people who are coming up because I had that fantastic stroke of good luck.
One of the exciting things about this conference is, in addition to standing in front of a group and talking a little bit about how we approach the work, there's no green room. We'll be able to talk one-on-one with people and spend time with people and have lunch with people and talk about their work and get to know. And I think that's almost at every level of all the people who will be at the conference. So a lot of the work relies on being, as Joyce said, in a community of writers. Because when you have that support, when you're sitting at your kitchen table in the middle of the night, it's really helpful to know that there's a lot of other people in the world who are at their kitchen tables in the middle of the night trying to get this done too. And if you meet them and you interact with them at any level, that's you. And you get to see yourself having the ability to reach those goals as well.
Yeah, and that we all did it. We all sat there in the middle of the night and cranked out our first manuscript while the kids were screaming and crying and while dishes had to get done and while all those life things were still happening. We've all been there and we're all here to get you, shepherd you.
Yeah. Well, the nice thing about this, I'm just going to, I can keep going. You had asked about the variety of things that are available at this conference. And I think what I personally learn every time I take on a new project is you bring everything to everything. So maybe you're a poet and you're writing a novel, or you're not. For myself, I'm not a very good poet. But the more you know about poetry, the better novel you can write. You might be writing memoir and you might be a short story hack. But the more you know about writing short stories, the better your memoir is going to be. So the opportunity to see all these people who do all these things informs all your work. And that's rare in a conference. So I'm pretty excited about just personally going and listening to people who do a lot of different things. It will inform all my work.
I guess what you're also making me think about is the fact that we live in this Lehigh Valley, what we call the Lehigh Valley, which seems to have a rich tradition of the arts and writing. I gather that you feel like you're already a part of some kind of a community here.
Even a hotbed, I would say. A hotbed.
Yeah.
Will people be coming to the conference from all over the country? Is it going to be
That's my perception, yeah. We've gotten registrations. I don't know exactly where everyone's from. I think I know of several people from New York. We've advertised more, I would say, along the East Coast and kind of focused our advertising there, though we've also had run ads in some national publications. So I think that people will be coming from further afield than the Lehigh Valley. But at this point, I'm not aware of anybody coming, you know, from the West Coast, but I just don't know, actually. I hope someone does.
I was sort of hoping for at least one wagon train. I thought it would be cool if there was a wagon train coming.
Reverse wagon train.
And I don't want to forget also to give you a chance to say something about the community partners and the people who are helping you sponsor this.
Thank you.
I think that's an important piece.
Yes, thanks for that opportunity.
Message.
Well, the college, Moravian College, of course, has been a wonderful supporter and backer of this. So that's probably first and foremost our main sponsor, Air Products. It has provided us with wonderful support to go toward scholarships for students to attend the conference, and also for some teachers to attend. So that's pretty exciting. We have gotten grants from the Lehigh Valley Arts Council, from the Bethlehem Fine Arts Commission, and the Moravian Bookshop is our dear partner in providing books for all of these people who are coming, and boy, are they patient, as I say, you should also get this one, you know, because we're going to have books available for sale throughout the conference by our many presenters. And they've published a lot of books, so it's going to be Phil Payne Gallery. You're going to have tables full of books. So they're on board as a working partner with the conference.
And am I to understand then that in the workshops that you have, you'll have people of all ages, including you're going to have young adults in your workshops. Is that what's going to students? Is that?
There will be some, yeah. Yeah, there will be.
Okay.
So they'll range from the youngest, I think, will probably be 11th graders who have just completed their 11th grade year. So we're talking 16 or 17, and I'm guessing we may have those 80-year-olds too. So a whole range.
It's very exciting. I guess that the other thing I guess I wanted to just sort of think about for a second as we move on into thinking about your particular the work that you do, Paul and Jordan, and also about writing, you know, as a discipline. I am curious to know how you define the young adult audience. I have a document here that has the reading selections for 5th and 6th graders, and it includes so many books that I wouldn't call young adult books. I don't understand where this term comes from. Catcher in the Rye.
I think in many ways the young adult category was invented in the 70s as a place to put books that would appeal to a certain buyer. The Robert Cormier books, what's her name, Shoots Smack, I can't remember.
Dinky Hocker,
yeah.
Smack.
So all of these books, they didn't fit on the adult shelves, and yet they dealt with more mature topics in 3rd and 4th graders. So the category was invented as a way to shelve books in bookstores.
Right, so you could put Judy Blume's Forever somewhere without, you know, completely horrifying a 3rd grader and ruining their entire pre-adolescence.
Yeah. But then from there, people started writing to be on that shelf. I don't think Robert Cormier was writing to be placed on a YA shelf. He would roll over in his grave.
Yeah.
So, but then as those books became popular and they became a way to promote good literature for that reader, the category has grown and developed over time. And in terms of defining what young adult, middle grade is, who knows? It's right. Whatever that kid reads. If it's the right book for the right kid, the end. But it's really a way to sell books.
And I would even say, for me, it's about the voice of the character. I never think about whether I'm writing for, you know, 13-year-old brown to blonde-haired boys who are between 5'2" and five. You know, I don't think at all about the audience. I think I have a character's voice in my head, and I'm trying to tell the story of that character in the voice of that character. And I think that is sort of borne out by the fact that actually I think now very close to a majority of the people who buy YA in stores are adults.
Okay.
You know, so I think what defines it now isn't the audience even as much as it's the voice of the character.
Okay.
And the situation.
That's very good.
Peggy, it's time for us to take a break here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. We're talking about writing for young adults, and we will be back in 60 seconds.
For program support on WDIY, we thank the Allentown Environmental Advisory Council presenting their second annual Sustainable on Saturday, May 3rd from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Allentown Brew Works, a celebration of Lehigh Valley initiatives to protect and sustain Allentown's environmental resources. For more information, 610-437-7610.
Okay, this is Peggy Campbell back with Joyce Hinnefeld, Jordan Sonnenblick, and Paul Acampora talking about writing. Jordan, I wanted to say that I read your book, this is most recent book, right? Are You Experienced? And I'm not a young adult. I was born in 1950, but I couldn't put it down. So I thought I loved the voice in that book, and I loved the subject matter because it deals with Woodstock and some history that I have experienced personally. But I would like to ask you now, Jordan, if you could tell us a little bit about your experience being a student. I guess it was in high school, a student of Frank McCourt.
Yes, absolutely.
Pulitzer Prize-winning author.
Well, Mr. McCourt was my homeroom teacher, actually, for 2.5 years. And I can't call him Frank McCourt. It's just too bizarre. It's Mr. McCourt. he was my homeroom teacher, and from sophomore through senior years of high school. And he was the sort of guru English teacher that everyone wanted to have. And I kept requesting his creative writing class and getting other electives that I didn't want. So I'd request creative writing and get journalism and hate it. And then I would request creative writing and get poetry and hate it. And then I would give up and request regular English and hate it. And finally, senior year, I requested creative writing again, didn't get it, and stormed his classroom door and just wouldn't leave until he let me be in the class. And, you know, he knew me. I said, I don't care if I stand here until the end of the semester. I'm not leaving. And, you know, he had this very heavy Irish brogue. And he said, Jordan, you're going to have to sit on the radiator. And I said, well, I don't care. I'm not leaving. I don't care if my butt looks like a waffle from radiator burns. I'm not leaving. And he said, fine. And he signed the paper. And it was in education. Having Mr. McCourt for an English teacher was like having Yoda for your lightsaber training, you know.
Where were you?
Stuyvesant High School in Manhattan.
Okay.
And it was a math and science, a specialized high school for math and science. So having Mr. McCourt was this just breath of, holy cow, nothing's an equation. I get to do creative writing. It was this amazing thing. And you had all these sort of really bright kids who were in math and science, and they were desperate for the creative writing part. And he was the guy, which is why his class was so crowded. And you could just sense that he was real. And then 9 years after I graduated, Angela's Ashes came out.
Oh, okay. And at that point, he was, I guess, just kind of working on his material.
Yes. And he would read his material to his classes sometimes. He never did with my class, but the year before I had him, my junior year, he used to read stuff all the time to my best friend's class. I think he must have not been revising actively when he had me. So when Angela's Ashes came out, all that material was new to me, but my best friend said, yeah, I heard all those stories.
Wow. Sometimes, you know, that chance to just have contact with someone who has all of that greatness. Now, he went on to write a few more works, but nothing quite, I think, compared with Angela's Ashes. I mean, that was his...
Although I have to say, for me, reading Teacher Man was about people I knew. You know, so reading Teacher Man, I was just... It had this sort of mystical thing. I kept waiting for my name to be in it, and I was in his last class. So I quickly flipped to the back, you know. And the last anecdote in the story was about this girl I had a crush on in high school. And I went up to him. I was flying to the National Council of Teachers of English convention in Pittsburgh the week the book came out. I read the book. He was the keynote speaker. And I went up to him and I said, Mr. McCourt, I can't believe you wrote about that girl. I had a crush on her, you know, in high school. And he said, oh, Jordan, didn't everyone? You know, and he just, there's nothing bad I can say about having Mr. McCourt for English. It was a tremendous influence on me. And then he paid me the tremendous honor of writing a jacket blurb for my first book.
Very nice.
You know, all around, it was a great life-changing thing.
Well, this is a question that I always have to ask writers when I'm in their company, and that's, when did you realize that you were a writer? If I could ask that of all three of you, because Joyce, I know you are also, you know, a prolific writer. When did it hit you? I mean,
well, I always answer that question by saying so many people I know say, "Oh, I knew from the womb," you know, or I wrote my first book when I was five, and I really don't think that I sort of didn't have that way of thinking about myself. It wasn't really steeped in writing. I read a lot, but didn't think that was something I would be able to do. And I guess, like many people, I had a college creative writing course that turned me around, you know, and kind of put me on my head and made me think, oh my gosh, this is what I've been waiting for. This is what I've been trying to do. And then ever since, it took me a long time to really own that and say, this is what I want to be, this is who I am. And still, I still struggle sometimes to call myself a writer, you know. But that was probably the moment for me.
Okay, for me, it was kind of the family business. My grandfather, who was my idol, was a high school biology teacher and wrote high school biology textbooks at night. My mom had written two sort of how-to books. My great aunt had the best writing career. She was an editor of textbooks for school use and a middle school assistant principal by day. And then she wrote like these bodice-ripping stories under a pen name for Cosmo by night. So by day, she was Ida Meltzer, mild-mannered assistant principal, and by night, she was Irina Mellert, bodice-ripping Cosmo woman. And so it was just kind of the family business. I always thought of myself as wanting to do what all my relatives did. I wanted to be a writer because I thought it was so amazing to see my grandfather's name on the spines of his books. And there was just no doubt I wanted to do that someday, because it was sort of the mantle or the birthright. Everyone else in my family had their name on a book.
Nice.
I was a talker. I was a storyteller and a talker, and everybody would tell me, you should write those down. Those are so funny. You're such a great storyteller. And I kept thinking, that is a lot of work. And I just kept putting it off. And then I would dabble for now and then, but I never took it seriously until I was well past 40 when I thought, maybe I will write this down. And I discovered if you sit down and you practice and you practice and you practice, you can write a story, but it's a lot harder than telling it. So they were right. I should write them down, and now I do.
And so then how did all these years of teaching, because now all of you are also in the practice of teaching, so how does that interface with the writing? I mean, it can sort of get in the way of the writing in some ways, but it sounds like for all of you, it probably enhanced
it. I used to be a kindergarten teacher, and then I've also taught, of course, at a lot of other levels now. But teaching is storytelling, and you need to have a beginning, a middle, an end. You need to hold the attention. You need to have a hook. If you start droning on, you lose your audience, and especially writing for young readers, you need to keep those readers engaged. And if you can teach kindergarten, which I wasn't a particularly good kindergarten teacher, but if you can do that with young readers, then you're halfway there because you're a storyteller when you're a teacher.
Okay. And for me, I think the big things were, one, studying this strange and mystifying beast called the adolescent and its native jungle habitat of the middle school. And then second of all, teaching literature is dissecting books. You know, it's tearing them apart and showing kids how they work. And in the process of doing that over and over again, I sort of saw how to construct one. Mm-hmm. You deconstruct them enough times, you see how to reconstruct them. And specifically, like, for example, the day I stayed home to write my first, to start writing my first book, I took Paul Zindel's The Pig Man, which was, I think, is the perfectly constructed, the original perfectly constructed young adult novel. And I counted the number of words on each of three pages, averaged them, multiplied it by the number of pages in the book, and I figured out that a young adult novel should have 50,000 words. And what's funny is I told that story at a writer's conference, and Richard Peck, who's a multiple Newbery Award winning young adult author, was in the audience, and he was speaking last. I was, you know, the little guy who was speaking first. He was the big guy who was speaking last. And he got up and he said, I have goosebumps up and down my arm because the day I quit teaching to write my first novel, I stayed home and counted the pages in The Pig Man, and that's how I figured out how long my first book should be. So fantastic. there's this tradition that's handed down, and it comes by looking at the books that came before and pulling them apart, and teaching trains you to do that.
That's so interesting and foreign to me, I have to say. I mean, I think as a writer, I'm a lot messier than that and can't recognize how the books I've written happened. You know, it's hard for me to reproduce the process. I'm a pretty methodical person about certain things, but I think I haven't been traditionally about writing. And as a teacher, I don't want to say I'm a sloppy teacher, but I struggle with the performance part of teaching and find that I'm rather introverted. And I've talked about this and actually written about it. The conflict for me is always there when I'm in the classroom. The desire to perform and engage and get people excited about what we're doing, and mostly I teach writing, creative writing, with some literature also. The struggle to do that at the same time that there's a part of me that just wants to not talk to anybody. You know, I want to be in my messy room working on my messy manuscript. But then there are times where my teaching experiences absolutely feed what I'm doing. And so it's not black and white for me, but I would say it's been a little bit more complicated juggling the two.
Maybe some of it is that when you're teaching younger kids, you have to advertise. Half of what when you're teaching middle school writing, a huge part of what you're doing is advertising for reading and writing, whereas they've chosen your class.
Yeah.
So maybe that's
yeah.
part of the difference.
I think you're still advertising, though. You're still sort of trying to say, you know, passion for this makes sense. You should win that argument with your parents who want you to change majors.
Okay.
You know, there's a lot of still cheerleading for the value of the humanities and the value of literature, even at the college level, I think.
Okay, I guess especially in this particular time where there's this hot topic about it.
Yes,
I guess
right.
What you're also making me think about is that other question about whether one can teach writing. And I think that one of the things that you're touching on is the fact that to be a writer is really to be persistent and sort of patient and have these passion and the need to write. And let's say,
masochism.
Drive, yeah. And what's the word? Yeah, yeah. Masochism and all of those things, which are not really things that one teaches, right? Although I suppose that one does help people acquire a habit of being persistent.
One can teach self-flagellation.
So where do you get to that point where you're actually teaching writing? And I suppose that when sometimes you have a student, you can see that the student burns to write. Mm-hmm. And that's, you just have to get out of their way.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
And then for the rest of us.
Yeah. But, even the student who burns to write needs a reader or readers. And that's where I think, that's usually my answer to the question of can it really be taught? And people do ask that all the time. And maybe not, but boy, it can be really valuable to sit in a room full of people who are trying to do it and talk about it, and provide an audience for those people. And that's, to my mind, the greatest value of a writing class.
Yeah, and I think you can provide those people with exercises that shape their thinking and inform, give them a structure. Someone can show up at a tennis training camp and say, I burned to play tennis. But you have to show them the rules of tennis and give them an opponent and give them a can of balls and rackets and the tools and water and the infrastructure they need. And a writing workshop, for example, is sort of like that. You're giving them the infrastructure and carving out the time, for example, here's a room, here are the people, here are the exercises, now write. And you're giving them instant feedback, which people love instant feedback. Mm-hmm. People need to know that their work isn't just disappearing into a void. And all of those things, you can burn to write all you want, but there's something beautiful about having this venue for it and this infrastructure around you while you're doing it.
Yeah, every writer I know is about half a day away from never writing another word and just saying, this is ridiculous. Why do I do this? And for me, going to a conference or going to a place where I was a student and having a teacher or a real writer say to me, no, don't quit today. They don't know. You don't know how much that carries you forward. And then you get to a place where I feel fortunate to be around people that actually ask. I don't even have to ask them to say nice things about me. and so it gives you that energy. But when you go to a conference, you're really asking for some confidence, some vote of affirmation, some reason to do it again tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So to be a writer is to be a reader. And I also wanted to find out if you could just tell our listeners the authors who have influenced you and to become the great writers that you are.
If we take as assumed that we are indeed great writers.
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah. Hey.
Thanks.
I'm quoting that to my mom when I was out there tonight. I'll take that. For me, the two writers who were most formative of my style were Mr. McQuirt and Kurt Vonnegut. And for the same exact reason, they both taught me how to write funny books about sad topics, which I think is my little ecological niche, is that I write funny books about sad topics. And I think I just learned that from studying Mr. McQuirt. And then I guess I studied from Kurt Vonnegut first because I read him first. And then my finishing school was Mr. McQuirt.
For the work I do now, Lori Hall Sanderson, who will be here in June, Kate DiCamillo, Christopher Paul Curtis, David Lubar, Jordan. I mean, people who are funny, but it's not all about the punchline. And I didn't know you were allowed to do that. I didn't know you were allowed to be funny about sad things. Mm. And the first time I read Speak, I literally closed the book and said, I didn't know you were allowed to do that. Christopher Paul Curtis's Watson's Go to Birmingham, 1964. It's a hilarious book until the bomb goes off in Birmingham and kills three little girls. Mm. The book is hilarious. And it's also real and hard and heavy and light. I just didn't know you were allowed to do that. So when I read that work, I want to make that work.
Yeah, and I would agree that Paul does that very, very well. There's a gentleness about Paul's writing, but there's also this humor is a tool for setting him up so that the sadness knocks him down. Mm-hmm. And I think sort of learned that maybe from other authors, and then we internalize it. And yeah, the worst thing in the world is when you see a punchline and you're like, that's a deliberate punchline. That doesn't fly. It's not sophisticated.
Yeah. I want to make people laugh, but I don't want to be on The Tonight Show. Yeah.
Well, you're reminding me, too, of a passion that I've had recently, which is for Buster Keaton. I don't know.
Beautiful.
I mean, to me, his work is pure poetry, and it's that laughing in the midst of what, you know, can often be really quite disastrous circumstances.
Mm. Actually, I do want to be on the Tonight Show.
The next thing I'm just curious about is to know what's inspired, at least your most, and I would love to talk about all your books, but maybe if we could just talk about your most recent books, Paul and Jordan, if you could just say maybe what inspired you to...
Sure. My book, I Kill the Mockingbird, comes out on May 20th. And just a few years ago, there was a bit of a dust-up conversation that was happening among librarians when the Wall Street Journal was bashing summer reading lists for young readers as literary losers. And there were a couple of things interesting to me. One was the whole idea of summer reading lists, summer assigned summer reading, and also how quickly that conversation sort of went viral because of the internet. Mm-hmm. And those two things together sort of were bubbling around in my head. And the title, I Kill the Mockingbird, sort of came into my head as just a funny line. I didn't know what the book would be about. I didn't know anything except the line that was driven from that. And when I shared it with my editor and publisher, they said, "What's it about?" And I went, "Three friends who sabotage their summer reading list." And they said, "Great, when will it be ready?" And I went, "I haven't written a word." But so it really just started by listening to people talk about books and how much they love books and the tension of assigned reading. So from there, the story started falling together pretty quickly.
Wow. And my book, Are You Experienced, is a lighthearted romp about heroin addiction and early death.
Another comedy, huh?
Yeah, another one of my vaunted comedies. Well, you can really see the light and dark in this book, which, you know, I kind of said I learned from Mr. McCourt. I found out that when I was 42, 2 years ago, I found out that someone with whom I had grown up died of a heroin overdose at 40. And it really hit me because when we were teenagers, we used to tease this kid that one day he would die of an overdose. Because he was the kid who, if everyone would sneak one beer, he would have eight and pass out. It was very obvious that he could not control himself if he had any kind of substance. And then when I found out that he actually had died of a heroin overdose at 40, I thought, how horrible for his family. They must have seen this coming from the time we were 15, and nobody could stop it. And I was driving to meet another author, a friend of ours named Wendy Mass. I was supposed to be writing a keynote speech with her that we were supposed to deliver that night. We were meeting for lunch. And so we were on the clock, we were on a deadline, supposed to be writing this keynote speech. And instead of thinking about that, I was procrastinating. I was listening to 1960s music on the radio of my car. And I was thinking about this friend of mine from our teenage years who had died of a heroin overdose. And those two things went together, the 60s music and the overdose. And I thought, what if I could have gone back in time and told him, not just, hey, you're going to die of an overdose, but you're going to die on this date, and here's how. And that's where the story comes from. It's about a kid whose uncle had died before he was born of a heroin overdose. And he gets a chance to go back and tell his uncle, you are going to die on this date, here's how. And it's about regret and about trying to change the past.
You're right that the message, that the subjects are serious and in some ways, you know, about some of the darkest parts of being human. But the voices for both of these writers, your voices are tender.
That's a good word.
Yeah.
And on that note, we must take another break. So this is Lehigh Valley Discourse. Peggy Campbell is our guest host this evening, and we will be back with our three writers in about 30 seconds.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Galicia, and Brittany, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Bringing you music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar every Thursday from 7 to 9 on WDIY Allentown listener-supported community public radio.
This is Peggy Campbell at Lehigh Valley Discourse with Joyce Hinnefeld, Jordan Sonnenblick, and Paul Akampura. We're talking about the upcoming Moravian Writers Conference, and about writing for young adults, and also writing as a discipline, as an activity. I think right now I'd love to hear a little bit more about your writing processes, how you actually put these things together. A novel is such a complex organism, and I could say that about a short story and a poem. I could say that almost about one word, but the novel in particular. So how do you actually sit down and decide where to start, how to carry it out?
Gosh, I don't decide. It hits me in a flash, like a sort of a haiku-like flash. Either the whole novel hits me in a flash or it doesn't. So, for example, Are You Experienced hit me when I was in the car driving from on the little stretch of Route 287 between Route 78 and the Garden State Turnpike in New Jersey, which is only about 20 minutes. And by the time I got from the top of that stretch to the bottom of that stretch, I'd gotten the idea, called my editor, called my agent. They had both green-lighted it. They had called each other, and I knew that the editor was going to buy the book. It hits me that fast. I had the whole pitch, and then I was already just down to developing the nitty-gritty of how the plot lines were going to happen. It either hits me in a flash or it doesn't. With me, it's not planned or careful, or it's not like doing a puzzle and figuring out what pieces will work. It either hits me organically as like one big satori, or I've got nothing.
Wow.
Yeah, and somewhat similarly, I guess, I keep a notebook like many of us do, and I just jot down little ideas, and some of them are very slight and they're short story-ish, but sometimes like I Kill the Mockingbird, or I'm working on a new novel now called Chasing the Gramosaur, the idea feels whole and there's enough there, and I don't know what it's about and I don't know who's in it, but the idea feels potent and I know that I can spend, because I'm going to have to spend a year or 2 years. Yeah. Fleshing it out, but it really needs to feel very potent in order to invest myself in it. And in terms of writing a novel, and I say this to everybody who asks, I don't write novels, they're too big. If you thought about writing a novel, you would drink bleach. It's not worth it. You write scenes, and then you write chapters, and then you string them together, and now you have a manuscript. But if you thought about sitting down to write a novel, you don't.
Right. And I mean, it's in fact, I sometimes write out of order. So, for example, my second novel, Notes from the Midnight Driver, I had written my first novel, Drums, Girls, and Dangerous Pie, all in order from beginning to end because I was, nervous. It was my first novel. I should go A to B to C to D in order. My second novel, I got cocky and I wrote the beginning and I wrote the end. And then I had to write parts of the middle to fill in the blanks. Mm-hmm. I didn't write it in order. And if that novel had been the Transcontinental Railroad, the golden spike would have been like page 118. Like that was, it was a random page in the middle that I actually wrote last. So my giant victory when I ran around the house going, I finished the book, was like page 118. It was a random little scene in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Well, to bring back a reference to Buster Keaton, apparently when he was making his short films, he said we would have the beginning and we'd have the ending. And then we would just let the middle happen on its own. Now, you both deal with different subject matter that I think takes research, if I'm not mistaken,
God,
right?
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, you got to get it right because you have to respect your readers, especially because they're young and they're in school and they know more stuff than I do. So if you're going to write a book that references To Kill a Mockingbird, or if you're going to write a book that references Woodstock, or if you're going to write a book that has a lot of birds and bird watching, you need to know what you're talking about, or at least you need to look like you know what you're talking about.
Yeah, people Google everything.
Yeah.
You will hear it. People Google everything.
And if you did get one little thing wrong, you'd probably hear about it.
Yes.
I've had that experience.
Yeah. So even though it's fiction, it has to be true.
So these subject areas, let's say, I think in your case, Zen Buddhism or the Woodstock, is that just an interest that you had personally, or do you find that you're constantly just coming up with new things that fascinate you and you want to...
Well, it depends. I'll take as an example, I wrote a book called Curveball, which partly is about photography and about a boy whose grandfather has Alzheimer's and is going through the stages of that. And the reason why photography is in that book is because my grandfather had died of dementia the year before I started writing that book, and my mom had given me his old camera. And I didn't know anything about photography, not the first thing. And I decided as a way to retroactively share an experience with my grandfather, I would learn from scratch how to do photography at a really high level. And I went out and I bought a really expensive digital SLR camera and some really fancy lenses. And I shot three of my son's next three sports seasons to learn how to be a sports photographer, and then wrote a book based on that experience. For me, it was about the healing of retroactively learning how to do something my grandfather had known how to do to feel closer to him. Although I came home with this, you know, super huge bill from Dan's Camera City and this camera equipment, and my wife said, you better write that book now.
How about you, Paul?
Well, I mean, to take To Kill a Mockingbird as an example, one of the nice things is it's a very, very popular book, which I love very much, but it's not, dare I say, my favorite book of all time. And in fact, the experience I had with it was basic. It was average. But as I started creating a character who is obsessed and passionate about that work, all of a sudden I'm in Reeves Library and at every library under the sun reading academic treatises on what Harper Lee was trying to do or failed to do and why it's banned. And you learn all of this background material about the what informs your story. 90% of it doesn't make it in to your story, but you need to know that in a way that your character would know it, so that way you can tell that story authentically.
Well, so that's a good example, because Harper Lee really didn't go on to produce any other great works of,
as far as we know.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a good point.
She's alive and kicking.
That's a good point.
And many people say she's writing even today.
Oh, excellent. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that I remember hearing about To Kill a Mockingbird is there was, I think it was some like 2 years or so in the editor's phase on from the original submission to, and
yes.
I wonder how editors work for you. Do you rely a lot on editors to help you get your manuscripts?
Yes. Well, my favorite To Kill a Mockingbird story is that, of course, Harper Lee was a young lady and it was her first novel. So like anybody who writes a first novel, she had no idea what she was doing, in the same way that nobody does. And when it was done, she opened up the window of her Manhattan apartment and took the manuscript, pre-computer days, and threw it out the window, like, and then realized what she had done and gathered a couple of friends. And we're running up and down the streets picking up the pages. She was so sure that it was just a train wreck of a book. Which it was when the manuscript was.
It's a great story.
Yeah. So yeah. So editors.
Yeah, I didn't do anything like that. I was in horror at the thought of that. You left me in stupefied horror.
Speechless.
Yeah. I don't know. With my editor, I think of it as some kind of like weird taffy pull. You have this, you know, giant chunk of taffy that's the novel, and you're both pulling at it in different directions, and you have to be careful you don't break it in the middle, or that you don't. You're wrestling, and you have different ideas, and I think ultimately, it winds up hopefully being a 50-50 or a 60-40 or something where you can both live with the sort of directional wrestling you've done, because it really is a collaboration, and hopefully, you know, kids think, teachers will say like, did your director make you change? Did your editor make you change things too much? And that's not really how it works. Your editor doesn't make you change things. Your editor says, this part it was hard for me to follow this part, or this part, pump up the funny in this part, or I didn't feel the relationship between these two characters was deep enough. Can you make me cry? You know, and then you go back and you're like, oh, I'll make you cry.
You want to cry.
Yeah, you want to cry. I'll give you a cry.
The editor challenge.
You know, right, your editor is challenging you. They're pushing you to be your best self.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a little bit personal. First of all, I want to just ask you a couple of questions about how you get your inspiration, and then I hope you'll read something from your book so we can hear your voices. But this question that I think is personal is, do you have muses?
No. No, I don't.
That's easy.
No. What about you, Jordan?
Do you have a muse?
Well, I will say, for my first book, I really did.
Okay.
For my first book, Drums, Girls, and Dangerous Pie, I had a student named Emily. When I was teaching in Phillipsburg, New Jersey, a student named Emily Penrose, who's 25 now. It's about to be the 10th anniversary of the publication of that book. And she had a little brother who had cancer. And I was one of those people that you meet all the time who say they're going to write a book someday but don't do anything about it. And I asked Emily's mom if she thought it would help Emily to have a book she could read that would help her talk about what she was going through, having a little brother with cancer. And Emily's mom said, please. And I went looking everywhere to find a book I could give to Emily about a little brother who had cancer. That was what English teachers do. You know, you find the perfect book to give to the kid. And the librarian said, there is no book like that. And the public librarian said, there is no book. Everywhere I went, there was no book. And then I had this little sort of dark night of the soul over Christmas break, wandering around my house going, you always said you were going to write a book. Here's a kid who needs a book. And then I really wrote my first book picturing this one kid who needed a book that didn't exist. And it was really all, that whole book was sort of the spoonful of sugar that I crafted around the medicine that this, that I felt this girl needed to hear, which was the message she needed to hear.
Oh, did the little boy who had cancer see the book? I mean,
No. I found out about 6 months after he died that he had known a book had been written inspired by him, but he died on May 10th, 2004, so it's about to be the 10th anniversary of that, too, which reminds me, let me just say, if you go to a website called jackshaves.org, that's jackshaves.org, you can donate to something that's very important to me. There's a boy in Chattanooga who organizes a massive head shaving to raise money for children with cancer, and I'm shaving my head. I'm flying to Chattanooga and shaving my head on June 1st, and I'm doing it this particular year in honor of Matthew, Emily's little brother, and in honor of other kids I've met with cancer, and in honor of the fact that it's been 10 years I've been in this, and I've met so many kids, and there's so much more work to be done and so much more support to be done for these kids.
Wow. This means Jordan will be bald at the Writers'
Yes, that is a good point.
Right.
I will
just
be,
wanted to
or
make that.
At least I'll have very slight baby head fuzz, because the conference is just less than a week later.
Be shocked.
Now, can you read some selections from your books? Would you do that?
Oh, gosh,
for
I'm going to have to speed read a selection from my book. We have a huge amount of time left. But yes, okay. So to set up the clip, my book has time travel in it, right? It's about a teenager from now who goes back to the 1969 to the Woodstock Festival, and he appears in the middle of a road and immediately gets hit by a car. So that's what you're hearing now. Friday, August 15th, 1969. They say we all come into this world naked and screaming, but most of us only have to do it once. The second time I did it, I was 15 years old, or negative 45 years old, depending on how you look at things. Like a five-year-old, like a newborn baby, I was immediately hit by a flash of blinding light as soon as I opened my eyes. Unlike a newborn baby, I was then hit by a Cadillac. Fortunately, it was a pretty slow-moving Cadillac, so I only spun maybe 15 feet through the air before landing in a nice grassy ditch by the side of whichever road I was on. It still hurt, though. Believe me, there's no such thing as getting gently hit by a Cadillac. The car's front bumper had nailed me in the right hip, which now pulsed and throbbed with a strange kind of burning ache. I lay on my back in the ditch for a while, catching my breath, smelling the sun-warmed soil around me, feeling the vegetation against my bare skin, and wondering where the heck I was. I was afraid to open my eyes again, because the first time hadn't gone so well. But then a shadow and a chill passed over me, and a soft voice said, "Hey, are you okay?" I couldn't help it. I looked and forgot all about my hip for a moment. The most beautiful girl I had ever seen was kneeling over me. She had long dark hair, parted down the middle, huge brown eyes, incredibly tan skin, and a look of shocked concern on her face. She was maybe a few years older than I was, and had on some seriously weird clothing. Shorts, a tie-dyed t-shirt, tons of beaded necklaces that were hanging almost down to my face, and a fringed leather vest that actually was brushing up against the skin of my chest. Because I was naked? Holy cow. My first rational thought was that this had to be a dream. I blinked several times really fast to see whether I would wake up. When I stopped, the beautiful girl in the retro outfit was still there. And now she was reaching down to brush my hair out of my eyes. She looked so kind and so worried that I had my second rational thought. Good God, I'm dead. That's what this is. The blinding flash of light, the car, the flying through the air part, and now this gorgeous hippie supermodel waking me up. It all makes sense. Now she's going to hand me a harp and a pair of wings. I said, are you an angel? Her eyes widened. No. I thought you were.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Jordan. And how about you, Paul?
Sure. Well, I'll be reading from I Kill the Mockingbird, which I mentioned is about three friends who sabotage their summer reading list as a way to inspire their community to read To Kill a Mockingbird. And in this scene, they're at a big chain bookstore in the mall, and they actually come upon a copy of To Kill a Mockingbird. The main character is Lucy, and it's written in the first person. So I'll I'll be Lucy. We turn and wander into a giant bookstore. Inside, we find several large tables holding dozens of different titles on display. There are bestsellers, true crime, and tons of discount books. There's also a huge range of recommended and required summer reading from all the local schools. Our titles are mixed in with a predictable set of classics, but there are some unexpected choices, too. I pick up a vampire fantasy that's stacked next to The Catcher in the Rye. Holden Caulfield is undead, I say. Who knew? Like I said, Alina tells me, you can learn a lot at the mall. How does Mort compete with this? Michael wonders out loud. The mall bookstore's got to be 100 times bigger than the small shop where we usually go. Alina takes the vampire book from my hand and tosses it back onto the pile. By being awesome, she says. Speaking of awesome, I lift a copy of To Kill a Mockingbird off another display table. Michael looks uncomfortable. What's wrong? I ask him. Lucy, he says, To Kill a Mockingbird is not my favorite book in the world. What's wrong with it? It's about a little white tomboy who worships her father in a town filled with wacky racist Christians and lynch mob farmers. It's a comedy about old-timey Southern people who treat each other badly. That is not what it's about, I say. Actually, says Elena, it sort of is. But not only that, Michael continues, the big hero in the book is Atticus Finch, who's supposed to be some kind of super lawyer, but three of his clients end up getting executed and he lets one murderer go free on purpose. Atticus Finch is not a hero because he's a good lawyer, I tell Michael. He's a hero because he's a good man. He could have been better. Michael, I say, we could all be better.
Thank you. Thank you to all our guests, Joyce, Paul, and Jordan. And just one more before we close, just one more plug for the conference, Joyce.
Yes, it's June 6th through the 8th, Moravian College's Heard campus in historic downtown Bethlehem. Visit moravian.edu/writersconference to learn more. Many wonderful things happening, and please register soon.
Thank you.
This has been Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY Allentown, and our special guest host this evening, Peggy Campbell, with her three guests, writers. Remember, as you go about your life, until we meet again, to be gentle with your neighbors.